We're currently looking at this slogan here for the ultimate bodhicitta practice, this slogan number 5, place your mind on the basis of all, the actual path. And I said there is at least two ways of interpreting that statement. The way we've been explaining in the previous session is that the basis of all is emptiness. Because emptiness is the ultimate nature of everything. And to place your mind on the basis of all means to place your mind in that experience of emptiness. And by doing that, and by realizing emptiness again and again and again, then that's the actual path. That's how we progress along the path to enlightenment, through realizing emptiness. So that's one way of interpreting. The other way of interpreting, which I think is more what's being said here in the commentary, is that the basis of all can be interpreted as the very subtle mind, the clear light mind. Because here it says, since this constitutes actual meditation of clear light. So in the Kagyu and Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, when they come into the Vipassana practice, particularly this nature of the mind practice, from the very beginning, we are trying to rest in the very subtle mind. So to place your mind on the basis of all means to let go of the coarse conceptual mind and rest as best you can, as an approximation at least, in the basis of all, in the very subtle mind. And that's the actual path. Because by resting in the very subtle mind and realizing emptiness, then we wipe out all the mental afflictions. And we can accelerate the path to enlightenment. So we can understand this statement in both ways. I think both ways of interpreting are fine. And also we read here, it said, keep your sessions intense but of short duration. Within one session you can have many sub-sessions. As for the length of the meditative session, it said that the best session should have a stable base and should end in a joyful state. So, in general, of course, with meditation, we want to emphasize quality over quantity. So not only in the shamatha practice, I think I mentioned that already, but here also in vipassana practice, quality over quantity. Because again, if we try and meditate too long here, we're just going to get caught up in dullness and distraction and probably lose enthusiasm as well. If we want to meditate longer, but we can't sustain it, then do as suggested here, is to have many sub-sessions. So if in the morning you want to meditate 45 minutes or an hour and you can sustain, and you can dedicate that amount of time to meditation, and you can't sustain that long in one session, break it into two 20-minute sessions with a little 2-minute break, or even three 15-minute sessions. Keep them short. How short? You should have a stable base and should end in a joyful state. So it depends on us, on our level of capacity. So to have a stable base, of course, means to have a very calm, clear, focused mind. Again, if we meditate too long, generally we either fall into distraction or to dullness. So that's not a very stable base. And should end in a joyful state. So this is one way to know if we're meditating too long, is that we should have the same enthusiasm to meditate at the end of the meditation as we did at the beginning. If our enthusiasm is dropping off, then we're meditating too long. And on that point, it's very helpful to have the same amount of time to meditate. So it's good to set a timer, actually. Because if we don't set a timer, what can often happen is on days we sit down to meditate, maybe on a particular day we're very agitated, negative state of mind, and really can't get into the meditation. So we try, and then after 5 or 10 minutes we're just frustrated, and then we just give up. That's not a very good habit to be in, because one of the things we definitely need in life in general, but certainly in meditation practice, is perseverance. If every time when things get a little bit difficult we give up, we're not going to get very far in meditation or in daily life. We need to be able to persevere in the face of difficulties. So if we've set a timer and things are a bit difficult, we'll persevere. So that's very good. On other days, if we don't set a timer, maybe things are going really well. We go, oh, things are going really well today, I'll just keep going. And of course, we keep going until when? Until it's not going so well. And then we stop. And the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we're always ending in frustration, dullness and distraction, we're going to start to associate meditation with not such good experiences. We're not going to be very enthusiastic to meditate again the following day. Whereas if we set a timer, things are going well, and then we stop, that's what we remember, we'll be enthusiastic, we'll want to meditate because we remember it was a very good experience. So therefore, very good to set a timer. But of course, we need to, as we deepen our practice, as we go deeper into the practice, we'll need to extend the amount of time we meditate. If we only stay with, say, 20 minutes, we're not really going to progress very far. So once we notice that, say, 20 minutes, it's very easy to do that, then we can extend, maybe, but don't double it to 40, usually 3 to 5 minute increment. So maybe 25 minutes, and then work with that for some time. And when you find you're very easily and comfortably can sustain that, then 30, 35, like that. And that way we can then really progress. So always emphasize quality over quantity. Okay. And then the last bit here, it says, the last part of that paragraph, at the conclusion, after dissolving your visualizations, cultivate great compassion for those without such realization, thinking, I shall place all beings in the undistorted truth of such ultimate mode of being. Dedicate all virtues to the benefit of others, then slowly undo your crossed legs and perform the 7-limb rites inside the chamber of divinities. So again, here what we see is, like at the beginning, to prepare ourselves well, set a good motivation. Here at the end, we can dedicate the meditation, not just for our own benefit, for the benefit of others. So it's always good to finish a meditation with a dedication. So that is the ultimate bodhicitta meditation practice, to really investigate the nature of reality. And here it started by saying investigate objects, then turn your attention to the subject. And then once you come to realize emptiness, whatever you're investigating, then rest in that experience as long as you can. So any questions about the emptiness of Vipassana practice?
It's a kind of connect. Looking for something about nutrition.
About?
Nutrition and food.
Oh, food. Oh, okay.
And the connection to meditation?
Sure.
Because...
Of course, our state of the body has a big impact on the mind. So we need to make sure that we're looking after the body as a basis for meditation, of course. And unfortunately, in our modern society, our diet usually is not very good. A lot of fast food and a lot of processed food. And that is a disaster for attention skills. I mean, we seem to have this epidemic of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in the modern society. And of course, there are a number of factors that contribute to that. One, I think, is genetic factors. But one of the main factors that are causing that epidemic is diet, particularly sugar, refined foods. It's an absolute disaster. You know, sort of fizzy drinks and sugar. I mean, it's an absolute disaster for meditation. So we really need to make sure that we're having a healthy diet, a balanced diet. And of course, on top of that, to have some exercise. In particular, it's good to do some body work that can help with the posture. You know, some yoga, tai chi, qigong. maybe more subtle body work, working on balancing energies in the body as well, if you feel that works for you. So this is all very helpful. And certainly when we come to meditate, and we're doing a retreat particularly, then, I mean, in general, we don't need to eat three big meals a day. I mean, that's excessive. And if you do that in retreat, you're just going to get very sluggish and tired. I mean, you're not going to meditate very well. And certainly, if you cut down the amount of food you eat, particularly in retreat, you're not doing a lot of physical exercise, so you don't need anywhere near as much food as we eat usually. Cut it down to one or two meals a day maximum, and you'll find your mind will be much more sharp and clear. And also, of course, not to meditate after you've eaten a heavy meal either. That's not going to work. But certainly diet is very important, and exercise, for sure.
So there is no book that like combines the two? Like I read some books in the Tibetan medicine. Like they say a lot about this, but could not find nothing in the Buddhist books.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, generally, that sort of thing in Tibetan Buddhism, you only tend to find in Tantra, in the level of Tantra. There's talk about different yoga exercises and often talk about diet as well. At the foundation level in Tibetan Buddhism, you don't see much of that. So I think that's certainly where we can complement our practice by bringing in something like yoga or something from outside that can really help work with the body. So you're right, there's not a lot talked about. I mean, of course, if you look, it says, you know, to have a healthy diet and look after the body and so forth, but it doesn't really go into a lot of detail. You see that more in Tantra, but at that level, it's more about, not so much about the physical body, but the subtle body. So then they talk about how to balance subtle energies and what foods to avoid that causes problems with subtle energies. But that's sort of at a very high level. I mean, at our level, I think it would be very good to supplement our practice by bringing in something like a yoga or something like that. And I think now also in our modern society, of course, there's a lot of stuff about diets and stuff, but some of those are a little bit dubious. But I think there is a lot of material available now that we can help us to develop a really healthy diet. And so I think we should do that. We should do that. But yes, you're right. There's not a lot of literature within Buddhism about that. And that's, I think, something we can bring in and supplement with. It can be very helpful.
Yeah, I was just thinking, because in the time of the Buddha, there was no sugar and no coffee. And he said the five precepts is no intoxicant.
Mm.
So this is maybe also...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the one of the reasons the precept of no intoxicants is there is not so much that intoxicants are inherently negative or something, to take some alcohol. But, of course, taking alcohol, if you drink too much, one, you're damaging your brain and body, but also often it leads to not so virtuous behavior if we're drinking too much. So this is the reason for the no intoxicants. And certainly, if we're doing any sort of retreat, if we're really going into any longer retreat, you really notice though any little changes like that. I mean, if you go into doing a retreat and you really look after your diet very well and cut out all the refined stuff and sugar, and then after a few weeks you take a little bit of sugar, I mean, you you immediately notice it. I mean, it's really like dramatic. I mean, those little subtle things. If you're doing retreat and you do a little bit, I remember normally in retreat I don't have any coffee, and I did a retreat last year. I was doing a retreat and I'd done sort of 4 or 5 weeks, and then I don't know, one day I decided to have a bit of coffee. Poof. Disaster. I mean, a disaster. I mean, the mind is just like all over the place. I mean, when you're really at that level, if you're trying to do a retreat, then those sorts of things are not very conducive. I mean, now, of course, our mind is so sluggish, a little bit of coffee maybe actually is good to perk it up a bit. But once you go into retreat and you really, I mean, it's really good to have retreat to really purify the body of toxins, you know, really, I mean, to really have a very sort of, you know, organic diet. I mean, really strip out all the toxins in the body. And then that's going to help a lot with the retreat, particularly if you're doing more than a week or two, you know, you're going into a couple of months or so, it'll be a big help to do that. I mean, of course, it's great for the body as well, but it'll be a very good support. And also, I haven't had the opportunity myself, but in Tibetan Buddhism, there is a particular retreat called the Chu Len Retreat, taking the essence. And in that retreat, they have these little sort of mineral pills. You know, they're just made out of minerals, and it's just to give you the basic minerals. And what they do in the beginning phase, usually you start like in a 10-day retreat. It's guided. And for the first 2 or 3 days, you're going down to zero food. And then the middle 4 or 5 days, you have no food, just have that and some liquid. And then you start having a little bit of food at the end. And I haven't had the opportunity to do one, but I have a few friends who've done it. And they say it's absolutely amazing how sharp and clear your mind is when you get in that middle period where you're not eating anything. They've never had that before. So this is an indication that, you know, that what we put in the body has a big effect on the mind. Okay. Any other questions? Otherwise, we'll move on to the next section, which is the subsequent period practice.
How's it called? The retreat you mentioned.
Which retreat? I've done a few.
Oh,
it's called Chu Len. Chu Len. It means taking the essence. And it's practiced in a number of the Tibetan traditions. Okay. So if we go on back into the text there on page 4 on the left side, the subsequent period practices. So remember, any practice has two parts, meditation and then what we do for the rest of the day. So if we're just meditating on something, even if we're doing it every day, but then the rest of the day we just run around as we normally do, we're not going to make much progress. So we have to bring whatever we meditate on into the day. We have to integrate it into the day. So here, of course, we're talking about ultimate bodhicitta, the Vipassana practice of emptiness. So how can we bring this emptiness practice into our daily life? What can we do? And there's one slogan here. It says, how to train in the subsequent practices is presented by the following. In the intervals, be a conjurer of illusions. So let's have a read of the commentary and then we can make some more comments on that. The subsequent periods must be cultivated without losing the flavor of your meditative equipoise on emptiness. So remember again this word meditative equipoise. Equipoise means balance. So meditative equipoise on emptiness means our experience of emptiness based on a balanced mind, on the mind of shamatha. Therefore, even though perceptions of self and others, the external environment and the beings within it, and so on arise, it is your delusion that causes non-existing things to appear as existing. So remember again, what's not existing is an independent me in an independent world. And that's what appears. What appears to us is an independent world and an independent me. They seem to be existing that way. So again, it's our delusion, it's our ignorance that causes these non-existing things, which are independent world, independent me, to appear as existing. So here, of course, we're not saying that there's no me and no world. We're saying that what is not existing is an independent me in an independent world, but that's what appears to exist. Contemplating such things as indistinguishable from illusory horses and elephants, relinquish clinging to substantial reality. Sometimes in the meditation, in the texts, it uses an analogy of this illusory horses and elephants, that there is, they talk about often about a magician who has maybe a stick or something they put on the ground. And then this in the old days, I don't know how they did it, but it often says in the text that then they blow this dust into the eyes of the spectators and they chant a few mantras. And then the spectator, instead of seeing the stick, they'd see an elephant or a horse. And so that's what's being referred to here, is that if we investigate, of course, there's no elephant or horse to be found there in the basis. There was just merely a stick or something that the magician used. So it says, relinquish clinging to substantial reality. Substantial reality here, of course, another word for stop clinging, stop grasping onto things existing independently. Although you perceive yourself in terms of your five aggregates, and we're going to look at the five aggregates now, you are but an appearance of the mere aggregation of dependently originated things. Apart from this, no self possesses an eternal unitary nature. Contemplate and set yourself as an illusory person who engages in the activity of going and coming and interacts with objects. Okay, there's quite a bit to talk about here. So the text says, although you perceive yourself in terms of your five aggregates, so the five aggregates is something that is very often presented here in the section of Vipassana practice, particularly when we're talking about the person, that the five aggregates are the basis of the person. So I think it'd be a good idea to explain the five aggregates so we have them clear in our mind, because they come up a lot. And the word aggregate is coming from the Sanskrit word skanda. And skanda literally means a heap or pile, a collection. So the five aggregates are five collections of things. And the five aggregates can be, most commonly, it's used to describe the basis of the person. The first of the five aggregates is the form aggregate, in Sanskrit, rupa. And when the five aggregates is a presentation of the basis of the person, the form aggregate, of course, is referring to the body. And so the basis of the person is the body and the mind. Mind can be divided up in many ways. In the previous session, we talked about the six consciousnesses as one way of dividing up the mind in terms of perceiving six different types of objects. Here, we divide the mind in a different way. And we divide the mind up in terms of our experiences, how we experience things. And then we divide the mind into two parts. We divide it into what's called primary mind, or sometimes called main mind, and mental factors. So whenever we experience something, The raw experience of the thing itself is primary mind. So primary mind is simply our basic experience of the object. And then mental factors determine what type of experience we have of the object. And mental factors here, we can make a list of many mental factors, but generally in Buddhist psychology here, we talk about 51 mental factors. That's the most common presentation. And I'm not going to go through the whole list because this is a whole topic itself.
But in Vipassana, Goenka, it divides in four parts of the mind, like perceiving part of the mind, recognizing, or what do I...
This is here, the same, yeah? same.
Okay.
Same. In fact, the four is the four, very four here. You'll see this in a minute. Mental factors here can be many things. 26 of the 51 are mental afflictions. Things like anger, jealousy, craving, resentment, anxiety, all of these things. So it seems like a lot of the mental factors that are operating in our experiences are these mental afflictions. Seems like we're not engaging in things in a very good way generally. So 26 mental afflictions in this list. I'll just mention a couple of other mental factors that are very important. One, of course, is the mental factor of feeling, which we've already looked at. Translation of Vedana. So this is our experiencing things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is often where we get into trouble, because it's on the basis of pleasant experiences we often have a lot of craving and attachment, and unpleasant experiences, aversion, hostility, anger, hatred, irritation, and so forth. So this mental factor often gets us into a lot of trouble. Therefore, it's highlighted. So actually what we find in the five aggregates, this mental factor is taken out of this list and listed separately. To highlight the fact that we really need to pay attention to this because it gets us into a lot of trouble. Another mental factor that gets us often into a trouble is what's called discrimination. Or sometimes translated as discernment, or even sometimes translated as perception. But that can be a bit misleading. But this mental factor is simply our ability to clearly distinguish one thing from another. And of course, if we don't clearly and accurately distinguish things, we get into a lot of trouble. So this also is taken out separately to highlight we need to improve this mental factor. We need to more clearly and more accurately distinguish things, to recognize things more accurately. Of course, another mental factor that we've touched on that's very important . Mindfulness, our ability to focus on an object without becoming distracted. And of course, in the mental factors here, we have things like wisdom. Another mental factor, very important, intention, because this is all about karma, intention. So we have many mental factors operating here. But again, these two of feeling and discrimination are taken out and listed separately, because they get us in to really highlight them, because they often get us into trouble. And then all the other mental factors are the fourth aggregate. Often translated as compositional factors. In Sanskrit, samskara. What Goenka calls the reactive mind. Because remember, most of these mental factors here are the mental afflictions, so we're reacting a lot. And they're called compositional factors because depending on what's present in our behaviour, That's literally composing what our future is going to look like. That's why they're called compositional factors. They're composing our future based on how we behave now. And then the fifth aggregate is then just the primary mind, what's left over. Often translated as consciousness, but here consciousness just means primary mind. So what we can see is that these four mental factors, these four aggregates together, is the mind. So what we can say is that the person is labelled on the five aggregates, or labelled depending on the body and the mind. But here in the text it says, although you perceive yourself in terms of your five aggregates, meaning we see ourselves as, this is me, I am the body and the mind, that's what it says, even though we see ourselves in that way, you are but an appearance of the mere aggregation of dependently originated things. Apart from this, no self possesses an eternal and unitary nature. So this five aggregates is very commonly presented in terms of the basis of the person. But again, if we want to simplify the five aggregates, we can simply say the person is labelled on the basis of the body and the mind. Or we can say the person exists depending on the five aggregates, if we want to use the extensive presentation. Any questions about five aggregates?
Discrimination?
Yeah. Discrimination sometimes is translated as discernment, to be able to discern something. Sometimes it's translated as perception, but that can be a bit misleading. This discrimination is simply our ability to clearly distinguish things. So my ability to distinguish that this is a bowl is this mental factor. So if this mental factor is not operating well, I may look here and go, lump of something, you know, or we see something and we misperceive what it is. So if that's not operating well, we don't recognize things accurately and clearly, and that's a problem.
When you say mind, is that the clarity and awareness is the same?
Yeah. So mind here is, remember the definition of mind is clear and knowing, or clarity and awareness.
The discrimination that you speak about now is the same.
What do you mean?
The clear. Now you spoke about discrimination.
Right? No, clear here, this word clear or clarity, sometimes translated, clarity. This word clear means, or implies at least two things. One, the word the mind is clear, has clarity, means it's not physical, it's not the brain. So it's not a physical phenomenon, it's mental. That's one of the ideas of the word clear or clarity. And the other one is, because the mind is clear, has clarity, means that things can appear in it. For example, a mirror, because a mirror is clear, you can have reflections appearing in it. Because the mind is clear, thoughts, emotions, and so forth can appear in the mind. That's the meaning of the word clear or clarity.
Okay. Can you go over compositional factors again?
Yeah. So we have 51 mental factors. So two that are taken out of the list is feeling, discrimination. To really highlight these two, very important, pay attention. These can give you a lot of problems, so that's where they're highlighted. Then compositional factors is this minus these two. Okay. It's what's left over. It's all the other mental factors minus these two.
Where are memories and that sort of stuff coming to? Are they in compositional factors?
Memories. Mental factor.
Or where do they come in?
I think actually they are compositional factors. Compositional factors actually can be mental factors plus other things like imprints and memories and
emotions
stuff.
Emotions and that sort of emotions.
No, that's a mental afflictions. No, compositional factors are these mental factors plus other things like imprints and so forth. That's also in here, yes.
Is that the samskaras?
Yeah, this is a translation of Sanskrit word samskara. Mm-hmm. Samskara. Anything else about five aggregates? Okay. So in the text it says that normally we see ourselves in terms of your five aggregates. So normally we say, this is me. I am the body and the mind. But here the text is saying that you are an appearance of the mere aggregation of dependently originated things. So the me is something, is a mere appearance. Again, the me is something merely labelled depending on the body and the mind. So there's no me to be found in the basis, in the body and the mind. Just like there's no pen to be found in the basis. The pen is something merely labelled depending on the parts. The me that exists is a me that is merely labelled depending on its parts, depending on the body and the mind, or if we want, we can say depending on the five aggregates. It says, apart from this, no self possesses an eternal and unitary nature. So here, there's something to say as well. This word, self. Here, in the context of Vipassana practice, when we see the word self, it's usually a translation of the Sanskrit word Atman. And a self is an overinflated false sense of me. Overinflated. We overinflate. We exaggerate. And so there are a number of ways we can overinflate the sense of me. One way, which is the one sort of mentioned here, no self possesses an eternal and unitary nature, is that at the time of the Buddha, a number of traditions also talked about sort of cycling in samsara and being liberated and life after life. And often in these traditions, they said that what achieves liberation and goes from life to life is a self. And often they posited that this self had three qualities. That it was unchanging, unitary, and independent. And I think this is what's sort of being referred to here, is eternal and unitary. But if we look at this, then we never have a sense of me in this way. Because that sense of me would mean that the me, or the self, is completely independent of the body and the mind. It would mean that we'd have to be able to have a sense of me over there somewhere. And we never have a sense of me that is not somehow based on the body and the mind. So this idea of self, of how we exist, is only something that we would come up with through some false intellectual process. That somehow we would think about it and say, well, okay, if there's a me that goes from life to life and achieves liberation, then for that to really work, it must have these qualities. So we'd only come up with this idea through some false reasoning. We would never instinctively have this false sense of me. But there is another sense of self that we do instinctively have. In fact, there are at least two other false sense of self that we have. One of those is that we grasp onto the me existing as self-sufficient, substantially existent self. What this means, self-sufficient, means that it seems to exist within itself. It doesn't seem to rely on anything else to exist. And substantially existent means it's very solid, real, and findable. And we do have this false sense of me instinctively. And we have it in our language, even. You know, often we say, I have a body. I have a mind. As if somewhere here is a third thing. A me that has a body and has a mind. It seems like that there's something more than just the body and the mind here. There seems to be something a little bit extra, a me, that has a body and has a mind. And that's how we often see ourselves, as this self-sufficient, substantially existent me. And this is the self that is refuted in Theravada. That if we can overcome this false sense of me, according to Theravada, we can eliminate all mental afflictions and achieve nirvana. The Mahayana here, which we're looking at, would disagree. The Mahayana says, yes, we do have that false sense of me instinctively, and it causes us problems. And if we get rid of it, if we come to realize there's no such me, very helpful. It will reduce our mental afflictions a lot. But here in the Mahayana, there is even a deeper false sense of me that we need to eliminate. That even underlying this, we are still grasping onto an inherently existent me, a me that exists independent of the world. So here in the Mahayana, if we really want to overcome mental afflictions and suffering, we need to not only, of course, eliminate this, but we need to eliminate this. So from a Mahayana perspective, coming to realize there's no self-sufficient, substantial me is not enough to even get to nirvana. If we realize it, very helpful. Mental afflictions reduce a lot. But there's a deeper level of grasping, a false sense of me at a more subtle level, and that is grasping onto this inherently existent me, a me that it seems to exist from its own side, independent of the world. So these are three levels of grasping. Again, from a Buddhist perspective, we don't instinctively have that. That's only from some wrong intellectual way of thinking. We do have that, and we do have that. Question?
Yeah. Of course, it's a wrong statement. I have a body, I have a mind.
It's not a wrong statement. It's a correct statement.
Correct.
It's a correct statement.
Then, there should be someone who knows about it.
Yes, the me.
About the me having the body, me having the mind, someone who knows, who just witnessing these sure. statements being pronounced.
And who is that?
Someone else.
No, someone else, no. It's me.
It's me again. It's like a kind of part of the mind is witnessing the other sure. parts of the mind and declaring and knowing
sure.
about all this game.
Sure. I mean, we can look at our own mind, can't we? We can notice when anger is arising in our mind, can't we? Mm-hmm. We can notice memories coming up in our mind. No problem.
Yeah.
Sure.
But then, I have a body. Yeah, clear. I have a mind. Yes. But then, who is this me?
The me that is merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. The dependent me. Mm-hmm. That's the only one.
Yeah.
Again, the problem with... It's not wrong to say, I have a body and mind. In fact, it's correct. The problem with using that type of language with our assumptions is that it leads us to feel, oh, there must be something a little bit separate, something extra, this me that has a body and has a mind. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to say that because we're stuck in duality. So using that language... based on our belief system of duality, it sort of leads us to believe there must be some me here that's not just the body and the mind. It's got to be something a little bit extra. Mm-hmm. That's this.
It's also possible to say that there are a kind of two me. One little me and one big me, like consciousness. I'm consciousness, who is the big self, who is having the body and the mind.
Right.
No.
Remember, here the word self
mm-hmm.
is a non-existent. The self does not exist, it never has existed, it cannot exist. It's actually crazy that a non-existent is the root of all of our suffering. Why we suffer is because we believe it exists. Absolutely crazy that a non-existent is the root of all of our suffering. And it's the fact that we just believe that it exists, that's why we suffer. Crazy. That's what this is saying.
So actually what it is, it's the Buddhism doesn't see what other religions see as a soul.
So again, soul is...
Because what he's looking for is soul.
Maybe, I don't know. But... again, I usually avoid these words like soul and ego and so forth. Because if I say soul, probably even in this room there will be at least five different ideas about what that word means. Then there's mass confusion. So, therefore, if you have an idea about soul, and your idea of soul fits one of these three ideas... if that's your idea of the word soul, then Buddhism would say there's no such soul. Can't exist. Illogical. But of course, we could define soul in a different way that maybe is compatible with Buddhist idea. The bottom line here... see, the bottom line is generally in most traditions, whether we talk about soul or Atman or whatever... most traditions want to point to something and say, that's it. That's it. But what we can understand here in this idea of emptiness, nothing is findable. So if you want to be able to point to something, you've missed it. You're grasping. You're stuck in duality. Of course, that doesn't mean there's no me. It just means there's no findable me. The me exists... as the text says, a mere appearance, something that is merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. That me exists. So if your idea of soul is that soul is something merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind, Buddhism would say soul exists. If your idea of soul is one of these, then from Buddhist perspective, soul
like
doesn't exist.
One of these is the watcher, is someone that...
again... if whatever tradition we're in, if we are using soul or whatever word, and we can point to something and say, that's it, Buddhism would refute that. Because in Buddhism, nothing is findable. Because findable means independently existent.
So also enlightenment, you cannot...
You can't find it.
You can't really...
In fact, there's a very famous verse that says, the mind has never been seen, cannot be seen, will never be seen, even by all the Buddhas of the past, present and future. So even an enlightened person cannot see the mind in terms of find the mind. Not findable.
But also enlightenment cannot... You can't...
Does it exist from its own side? No.
No,
nothing does. Even emptiness does not exist from its own side.
Yeah, if we accept the idea of soul, immediately we have to accept the idea of God.
No. It completely depends on how you define the word soul. The soul is just a word.
Okay. In Buddhism, there is no idea of God, but then there is a lot of praise.
Could.
To whom it is supposed to pray? Like what? Here it is written, prayers.
Yes.
To whom?
To yourself.
To yourself? Self as what?
Person.
Self doesn't exist.
The person. Yourself. Yourself. You exist.
So I pray to myself?
No. Look. And this is a big misunderstanding about prayers in Buddhism.
Yeah.
Prayers in Buddhism, as you normally see, are aspirations. They're not like, please do something for me, Buddha. Fix me. You won't find that in Buddhism. That's not going to work. It's a waste of time. Prayers are more like to your teacher, please advise and guide me and help me in my spiritual practice. Or may I meet with a qualified teacher. These are the sort of prayers you see in Buddhism. And it's all about healthy aspirations to plant seeds in our mind to meet with teachers, to so forth.
When I pray, may I meet a qualified teacher, I pray to whom at this moment?
To whom?
Yeah.
Nobody. You just make that aspiration.
Just aspiration.
Yeah. Because...
Because the word prayer means immediately, you pray, I pray to someone.
No.
Huh?
No.
This is a misconception.
Okay. Yeah.
So again,
my understanding of
So again, and often that's the background we come from, is a prayer is somehow where we're asking someone to do something for us.
Of course. Like in my country, people go to the church because they pray to God, Big Father, and in heaven, and they ask for something.
Sure. But I think even in Christianity, people who do prayers in a good way can benefit. But if we do prayers that say, please, Buddha, God, Jesus, fix my problems, I think that's not really going to be very helpful. So here, a prayer is to plant seeds in our mind, to have healthy aspirations. You know, so that's what a prayer is in Buddhism.
So then what are the different rituals and all that we do? Who are we actually doing it for? In Buddhism, if you talk about
yourself is the main beneficiary. Most of those, of course, there are other effects, but most of the practices in Buddhism, and we'll see this also in the Tonglen that we're going to look at, the main beneficiary is you yourself, because all of these practices are to transform your mind. And of course, they'll have a flow-on effect that you'll then help and interact with others in a better way. So you're not the only one who benefits, but in all of these practices, the main beneficiary is you yourself.
It's not like...
And what is the name of the link that comes from reincarnation to reincarnation?
The what, like, sorry?
Subtle mind, like this, which are like all the time. Like body comes and it goes, and new body comes and goes.
Yeah, but even... At all stages, there is a physical support.
And what is the name of this? Is it subtle mind?
At all stages, and we showed that earlier, is during your life, the me is labeled on the basis of this body and the mind, coarse mind. And both of those are changing moment by moment, all the time changing, changing, changing. In fact, the physical body you have now is 100% different than the body you had 10 years ago. Already, 10 years ago, your body now is 100% different. Not one cell the same.
Like, but then will be...
And then, of course... Sorry?
Body will, like, stay here and will come another one, body. But what will change?
Well, the body's changing and the mind's changing the whole time.
Like in next life.
Yeah, I mean, it's changing, both. Through the death process, the mind becomes more subtle, the body becomes more subtle, and then again in the next life, the mind becomes more coarse and the body becomes more coarse. At all stages, there is a body and a mind together. At all stages.
Just new body.
Hmm?
New body.
There's a new body every moment.
Okay.
Isn't there? So we've got to get over this idea that this life, there's a body, and then there's a new body. No such thing. In this life, in every moment, you have a new body and a new mind. Don't you? Don't you? It's changing in every moment, isn't it? And your body, as I said, is 100% different than it was 10 years ago already. 100% different. Completely different. Already. Forget about next life. Your body is 100% different than it was 10 years ago. Still, it's your body.
But what is the name of this energy?
There's no energy. It's, again, we're always wanting to point to something and say, that's the thing that moves from life to life. But as I mentioned earlier, in physics, at the physical world level, there's nothing that moves through time. In the mental, in Buddhism, in the mental world, there's nothing that moves through time. There's just a flow of change. At the physical world level, a flow of change. And in that flow of change, we make sense of that. And part of that is we go, body, bowl, laptop. But it's a flow, constant. And in that flow, also, we make sense, we go, mind. But that mind is not a thing jumping through time. It's a flow of experience. And whether we talk about this life, going to next life, there's just the flow of body and mind all the time. It looks very different at certain points, but it's just a flow. So there's no thing that you can point to that says, that's the thing that goes to the next life. Yeah? The mind continues. The body continues. Okay, at the end of this life, the body looks very different. But there's a continuity, a physical continuity at all times. There's a mental continuity at all times.
The Baldo part?
There's a subtle mind and subtle body.
What is the...
Subtle mind, subtle body.
There is a subtle body at the...
Sure, energy, energetic body. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Even the clear light of death, there's a subtle body, subtle wind energy. So at all stages in the flow, there is a mind and a body associated with it.
But this subtle mind can remember previous lives.
Our coarse mind can remember previous lives if we train it.
So this is subtle mind, or what is the name of it? Just mind, yeah?
Mind.
Okay.
The mind can be manifest at many levels. Now, the mind that is manifest is coarse. When we go into shamatha meditation, it becomes more subtle. If we go into tantric practice, the mind that becomes active in meditation is very subtle. So even in our life, we move up and down the level of subtlety of mind depending on how we train our mind.
Is self-sufficient and independent the same thing?
No. We can overcome this and still grasp onto this. Because this is actually what in the Vaibhashika Sautrantika philosophical system they eliminate. But in that philosophical system, they would say there is an inherently existent me. Because in that system, if something exists, it must be findable, including the person. So they don't see a problem with negating that and still asserting that this actually exists.
Mm-hmm. And what's substantially existent? What does that mean?
Again, here, they sort of go together. substantial existence just means really self-existent. You know, it's really solid existent, not really relying on other things.
So what's the concept of duties in Buddhism?
Deities. What's the concept?
That gets very confusing, because you're saying that you're making an aspiration for yourself. Then why do we have to have these images, or where are they coming from?
To receive inspiration, like a teacher. Is to receive inspiration from the deity or the teacher. Of course, we have to do the work, but we need inspiration. We need a lot of inspiration in our practice. So by part of that practice is to receive that inspiration.
But these deities, they exist by themselves?
By themselves. Are they beings? Yes, why not? Enlightened beings, yes.
They all are enlightened beings, like Tara and all.
Sure. Yes.
And demons?
Demons. most demons that we need to overcome are in our own mind. They're the most nasty demons that we have to overcome. Our demon of craving, attachment, anger, jealousy, they're the demons that we have to work against.
Thank you for that. It's very reassuring.
Okay.
Everybody has his private demons, yeah?
Inner demons, yes.
So is it like a Buddha has manifested into these different forms, or is it like separate people who have gained...
Both are possible. Okay, I wanted to finish this section here. So if we go on, it says, do not remain blank, thinking nothing, but instead be sustained by mindfulness. So again, here we see that if we want to practice this illusory-like emptiness practice in daily life, we need mindfulness. So again, the samatha practice. If we really want to question appearances in daily life, we need mindfulness. Otherwise, we're just going to react as we always have. And the instant something appears to the senses, think, this too is illusion-like. It is dreamlike. In this way, the experience objects by relying upon such adages as well. So, therefore, it's very important in daily life to have this mindfulness and then to question appearances. Particularly, very helpful when we encounter pleasant and unpleasant experiences, because they're the ones we generally react to the most. So whenever we encounter a pleasant experience or unpleasant experience, we can do this illusory-like emptiness practice. And we can do it a number of ways. One is that we investigate the object. And that object, of course, can be a person. And let's say we're having a very pleasant experience. Then that object, which could be a person, will appear very attractive from its own side. And so here, our illusory-like emptiness practice is investigate that appearance. Where is the beauty in that object or person? Try to find it. Try to find the beauty in the object or person. Or if we're having an unpleasant experience, try to find the ugliness or unattractiveness in the object or person. And just like you won't find the person in the basis, you won't find the beauty or ugliness in the basis. And if you can do that investigation and realize there's no beauty or ugliness there, we will realize that beauty or ugliness is in the eye of the beholder, which means we won't react to our pleasant experiences with attachment. We won't react to our unpleasant experiences with aversion. Alternatively, in the illusory-like emptiness practice, we can focus on the agent, the me, who's experiencing this. Where is the me that has craving coming up? Where is the me that is getting irritated or getting angry? And search for the me who is reacting or starting to react to this experience. And again, if you can't seem to find that me, then that will dissipate the mental affliction. So not only is this illusory-like emptiness practice helpful in deepening our understanding that things are not existing as they appear, and thereby that will feed back into our emptiness practice. Also, it will help us to, in the moment, reduce our mental afflictions and to help us to stop reacting, particularly to pleasant and unpleasant situations. So this is this illusory-like practice. So if we read the next paragraph, I think it says something like that. As you view everything in this manner, during the subsequent periods, subsequent means subsequent to meditation, means daily life, your mind will not become remote from the dreamlike experience of the meditation session. Meaning by doing this investigation, we're not going to sort of forget about our emptiness practice, and it's going to reinforce that emptiness practice. In this way, during the intervals between sessions, turn all your virtuous activities into the path, abiding thus in the great union, not losing the experience of the meditative session throughout all activities. To make these points, the master, and again the master here is Geshe Chikawa, cited the following stanza and explained the practices of the relevant points together with their beneficial qualities. Thus ensure that all your practices remain untainted by the clinging of grasping at real entities, and spread them across the vast space-like great emptiness. You will then travel in the sphere of immortal great bliss. So here we see this talk about this great union. Now, of course, there doesn't seem to be a union. There seems to be either things are empty and they don't really exist, or there is this real functioning world. But if we do this illusory-like emptiness practice, we will be able to unify those two things. We'll be able to unify emptiness and appearances. That we will, on the basis of appearances, we'll really realize that they do not exist as they appear. They are like an illusion. So therefore, we'll be able to unify emptiness and appearances, meaning the appearances in daily life can help to reinforce our understanding that everything's empty of independent existence. And so then they will become unified, this idea of emptiness and appearances. And that's what's being mentioned here. Any questions?
This idea of illusion life, dream life. So, when my husband tells me he loves me, do I have to reply, oh, darling,
it's an illusion.
No. Remember I said before, we're saying like an illusion.
Yes.
Not an illusion. So
his attachment.
Right.
His attachment is illusion-like.
His attachment is illusion-like, and therefore it functions. Therefore attachment functions. Remember, and this is the false understanding of emptiness that I mentioned earlier. And I see this, you know, people who I know who've supposedly studied and reflected on emptiness for many years, I still hear them saying things like, oh, it doesn't matter because everything's empty. I mean, that's completely the wrong understanding of emptiness. That's nihilism. What we're saying here, the union, is because things are empty, things can appear and function. And because things function, they must be empty of independent existence. That is illusory-like practice. Illusory-like practice, now things appear to exist independent of us, and we grasp onto them like that. That's completely opposite to emptiness. So for us now, it seems like emptiness and functioning world seem to be contradictory. But if we do this illusory-like emptiness practice well, we'll understand that the appearances and emptiness are two sides of a coin. That appearances are like an illusion. We're not saying appearances are illusions. We're not saying that attachment from someone else is an illusion and therefore it doesn't really exist. That's nihilism. What we're saying is that things are not existing as they appear. therefore they're like an illusion. But they are existing, they're dependent, and they function.
Can we say appearances show for our relations?
A measure that our practice is going well is exactly this. Now, appearances seem to cause us to believe that things exist independently when we see an appearance, because that's how it appears. But if we have going well in our emptiness practice, a measure is that simply by seeing an appearance, that will automatically deepen our understanding that everything's interdependent. If that happens, we're going well. So a mere appearance, instead of blocking emptiness and seeming to reinforce the idea that there is an independent world, if upon seeing a mere appearance, for us, that automatically strengthens our idea that everything is interdependent, we're going well in our emptiness practice.
So, in practicing Buddhism, I think I'll be a better Christian. Because to me, Christianity is a question of relations.
Sure, sure. In fact, another way I like to mention we talk about things being interdependent. But then we have this idea, interdependent, okay, that means there's one thing here, there's another thing here.
That's why I'm tired. Yeah.
Sometimes when we hear the word interdependent, we think, oh, there's one thing here and one thing here, and they're connected. No. That's not interdependence. Interdependence is the perspective creates the endpoints. The perspective of size creates big and small. I think this is what you're saying. So if by seeing appearances we can understand this, then we're going very well. So we can say everything's perspective. It's another way of saying it, a little bit poetically. But we could say everything's perspective. So by merely seeing appearances, if we get this idea, then we're going well. As opposed to this exists on its own, independent. If we, upon seeing this, we understand instantly that there's perspective, then we're going well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, last question, then we need a break.
Not directly a question, but maybe a question inside. In relationships, if you see the beauty in your partner, it means that your own beauty starts to evolve. Like, the more beautiful your relationships are, the more you are yourself in a state of beauty, because it's a reflection of your own beauty. It's how I tell it, because it's very beautiful, and I can't say it to my girlfriend.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to have come here.
Okay, very good. So this is the what's being said here, and I think this can be very, very important and helpful, beneficial practice, this illusory-like emptiness. It can give us a lot of help immediately in our life in terms of lessening our reactions, but also it can really help us to be fuel for our Vipassana meditation. Because as long as we're in daily life, we're just grasping, 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 then when we come to Vipassana meditation, with that strong grasping, it's very hard to break it down. Whereas if in daily life we're already softening that through this illusory-like emptiness practice, you will find that's going to feed in very well into the Vipassana practice. And then, of course, the Vipassana practice is going to go deeper, and then that will feed more into the illusory-like practice. That'll go deeper, and then it'll keep feeding themselves round and round, and then we really can make some progress. So this is something I think very important and very helpful and practical as well. On that note, we've finished now the training in ultimate bodhicitta. And tomorrow morning we're going to start, as we see here on page 4, training in the conventional awakening mind, conventional bodhicitta. And the method we're going to use here is this method of exchanging self with others. So now, I think in this session with Renato, you're going to do, again, a wisdom practice. You're going to do another emptiness practice. And then this evening, I think you're going to touch a little bit on this exchanging self with others, just to get a little bit of an idea of it, so that when we talk about it tomorrow, you have some experience already. So that'll be very helpful. Okay? Take a break. See you tomorrow.